Good morning, and welcome to the Liberview Radio Show. Today's broadcast is recorded on the 26th of March, last Tuesday, from my standpoint right now. And the podcast features an interview with Troy Miller, a candidate for the House of Delegates in Jefferson County, West Virginia. And we pick up the conversation after it was the recording was started, just after Troy had been introduced. So I'm adding this morning to it. Take care. I'd like to introduce you to our Labor Beat Radio program. These three sort of geezers here, J.B. Christensen, myself, and Scott Marshall, my comrade and brother from the lifetime, you know, from Chicago and the steel workers. We do this weekly whenever we're able, and try and talk about some of the top issues in labor and exchange views with people who are going to get involved on some of those incomparable issues and some of the same issues. So welcome. And I hope you just give us, if you can give us a few minutes of your outlook. You don't have to worry about convincing us to vote for you. We're supporting you. Okay, don't worry. But if you have some deeper thoughts and some things you've already thinking about learned or want to learn, you know, we're curious to figure out how we can help you and help build this movement to resolve the political crisis in this country. Thank you for coming on, Troy.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. And I'll just pick up on what you were saying, which is very simply, you know, the union movement is a movement of democracy in the workplace. And it is exactly, they're an exact parallel with political organizing. When you have one person trying to stand by themselves, saying one thing against whatever powers that may be, whether it's a captured political class, you know, politicians owned by corporations or a direct boss, they're not going to get very far. There's no reason for those powerful interests to negotiate with a single individual. But when people stand together, when we express solidarity, when we are unified, and, you know, that doesn't mean everybody in lockstep agreeing about every single thing. What it means is agreeing on basic things like people deserve a living wage. People deserve a right to collectively bargain and figure out what those things are. People deserve a right to participate in our civic life. All of these types of things are we are stronger when we stand together. One of the things I keep on going back to, it's almost a cliche with my campaign at this point, but you know, united, we are unstoppable. Together, we can do anything. And that includes in a state like West Virginia, where people have had sour experiences with the government for longer than I've been alive in a lot of ways. And that's both parties, it's Democrats and Republicans at this point. Although I think the Democrats are doing much better, which is why I'm running as a Democrat. I think there is a little bit more effort to reclaim the sort of FDR New Deal Democrats without the Dixiecrat racism that was sort of a necessary part of that coalition before. But people can see that the government hasn't worked for them and that it has worked for powerful, wealthy interests. And people then don't want to participate in our democracy because they don't see what the value is. And so my campaign, one of the tenets of it is just like in the workplace, when we stand together and make our demands clear and make our red lines clear also about where we're not, where, you know, the absolute bottom of negotiations have to be, we can accomplish a lot more. And we've seen that over the last few years within the union movement, with the UAW. It's just absolutely incredible what's going on there with the Chattanooga Volkswagen plant that within the last 10 years was sort of a lost cause. It was a crushing disappointment for the union movement, and now is looking like it might be the exact opposite. This is very impressive. And, you know, I am I am a name on the ballot running for office, but just like when it was Senator Bernie Sanders running for office in 2020 or 2016, I firmly believe that this is not about me, this is about us. And any campaign that's grounded in the people, I think, will inevitably win. Maybe not this time, but down the road, people do understand who is fighting for them, who is listening to them. And people who are out for themselves will eventually be, you know, they'll fall away and they'll lose because the self is not enduring. An individual we come and go. It's a historical blip, but a movement is really inevitably unstoppable. One more thing I'll say, then I'll kind of step off my soapbox here, is that people think that the American Revolution started at Lexington and Concord. And I think that's a tremendous misunderstanding. I think the American Revolution really started in the hearts and minds of the colonists in the decades before. And one of the revolutionary principles for the American Republic was this idea of property rights, which is a real improvement when you're comparing to feudal England or any of these other contemporary areas, that normal people, normal citizens at that point, you know, land-owning men in America, could have a right to property, and by virtue of having a right to property, have a right to participate in our civic democratic process. Was it a perfect ideal that we captured in the Constitution? No. Part of the property rights revolution there was also that whole swaths of Americans were property of another property class. That's a problem. And so 100 years over time, and there were abolitionists at the time of the American Revolution, you know, it starts taking hold and it results in a massive civil war that, again, the revolutionary principles of equality shine through. Coming up to the next crisis with the Great Depression, the minimum wage laws were not born whole cloth out of the 1930s or anything like this. This is something I'd been fought for 40, 50 years. And so this is all to say, and now we're starting, I think we're, what I'm hoping that this campaign can contribute to is realizing what FDR had enumerated in his second Bill of Rights, or an economic Bill of Rights, and we're running and promoting on a 21st century economic Bill of Rights. It's a little bit more expansive and up to date. It's not the 1940s anymore. But I believe that this is a part of this, you know, long arcs that we start seeing when you start looking at history that way and stop seeing a series of events and start seeing cultural changes that really take place over time. I could keep talking for a while on any of those issues, so I'll step back. Thank you.
You should be on the show. You should be on the show, Troy.
Anyway, Scott and JB, why don't you guys, you got some questions or thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Troy, you're incredible, man. You should be on the show every week, you know, because you pretty much outlined everything that we do on a week-to-week basis for many, many years. And it's great to hear it from a different voice. And I'm really excited about your campaign. And of course, we interviewed you and gave you the endorsement. And we didn't hesitate.
There was no any argument.
No, there was no discussion. You know, it was like, yeah, he's one of us.
Yeah.
So we really appreciate you coming on. And what do you that fundraiser that Maria had on Saturday was outstanding. And I hope to see more of that. I think that's how we get the Democrats back in sync, you know, is to have more events like that and where people can get out and create community and talk about the good things, you know, talk about what we want to do that are positive, as opposed to always being on defense, you know, always trying to fight some crazy nuclear depository or, you know, we don't have to give our kids vaccines or, you know, all the crazy bills that they passed down in Charleston. So it's great to see you on the scene, and I can't wait to start working with you and knocking on doors. That district, that was 98. That was Espinoza's was that, district.
Was that correct. Sammy's district yes. too?
Who?
Was that Sammy Brown's district too?
No.
Okay.
But it is Paul Espinoza's district, and he is running for West Virginia Senate. So right. he is not running for re-election here, which means it is an open seat, which makes it a little bit more in play than it would be yeah. otherwise. And you know, for your listeners, I'll just throw out there that you know, the state has been entirely redistricted. We are largely the same district that we were before the 2020 redistricting, but we're also looking at a district that had no Democrat on the ballot in 2022. And 2020 was such a strange year because, you know, exactly what you're saying, JB, we couldn't actually have all these events. People might remember there was a global pandemic happening, and that undermined a lot of the, populist energy the good sort of populist way, not the way that it's sort of maligned and thrown away. But a lot of the politicians or the candidates, not politicians so much, the candidates who were running for the people were all of a sudden their mechanisms that they had set out to for voter outreach and for keeping the energy high was really scuttled by the global pandemic, you know, looking at it, it's hard to know where to use as our template, where do we start? Where are we looking at? What's my win number? Is that people keep on asking me, and I think you can come up with a couple of different ones depending upon what you're looking at. And I'm less concerned about that because when I look at my win number, I go, okay, great, and then we have to add, let's say, 200 votes to make sure that it's in the bag.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I jumped in on you, JB.
What are the demographics of your district? Have you looked into that and to see? It seems to me, from my recollection, that's kind of an upper middle class mobile, upwardly mobile district where most of the houses are fairly most of the families there are pretty well off. Is that true or I got that wrong?
No, I think that's fairly accurate. I haven't been able to get too much into the district level particulars. I've been only really able to look at Jefferson County. But when you look at I kind of keep on thinking to myself, and this might be the first time I'm saying it, but District 98 seems to put the county into Jefferson County. We are a lot of the rural areas surrounding Charlestown, south of Route 9. We do include Rockwool, which is not rural, but is nonetheless in the rural areas. And it tends to be, there are a number of families who have been here for generations, and the land has been passed down through the family for generations. And in an absolute sense, I think those are probably pretty well-off people. How they feel about how their situation is versus generations before us, I don't think they feel as well-off. And then we also include Ranson, which is a lot of it's a growing area with, I think, a lot of people coming out of the D.C. Baltimore area moving out here for an affordable place to start a family and start a home while commuting. And so it's a little bit of a mixed bag. I think you have older, more well-established families. One of the Republicans, for instance, Joe Funkhauser, I know his family has been a long time farming family in the community. And then also newer people who have moved out here, especially since the pandemic. I mean, once again, there's just so much that if we looked at the trends from 2018 out without assuming a global pandemic, I think the demographics would look not totally different, but different enough. So I'm not sure if that answered your question or not.
Well, I'm just wondering about door knocking and being able to canvass a neighborhood and how many neighborhoods we can canvass. Just that, just boots on the ground kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Just Just curious.
Manson is going to be the area with the most neighborhoods, it seems like. But we also have Cable Town and Middle Way, and so it's a there are none of them rise to the level of municipalities, but there are neighborhoods.
Right. What
and then there's
the...
also a lot of land. It's a lot of
Let's pause for a minute. Let Scott, you got some thoughts or questions?
First of all, Troy, I have to apologize to you. I can't vote for you. And if I did, it would probably get us all in trouble. Hopefully. No, I wish I could vote for you. Actually, you were talking about one of the things that I'm always interested in campaigns, and that is organizing to get the boots on the ground and to get people out knocking on doors and stuff like that. And so, how are you preparing for that, and how's it look in terms of getting people out?
It's hard to tell right now because we don't have a primary opponent, and my opponents do. And there's a certain level of, we don't want to create voter fatigue. We don't want, we're going to have to win a number of independents, and Republicans in order to win this seat. And the simple fact is most of those independents in this district are probably going to take a Republican ballot in the primary, and they're not going to see my name on the ballot at all. And so it becomes difficult to build too much of a ground game this far out when, when it comes to storytelling, this type of, when we're talking about, why you should vote for me, there's also the aspect of why the other person is a bad choice. And right now we don't know which one of those other bad choices it's going to be. And I have no real interest in running against, both of them at the same time right now. So what we're really working on is building our lists out, making sure we have good data, getting our volunteers signed up. And it becomes difficult because we do want to have them doing something, but there's also not much to do. And this is the first electoral campaign I'm running as a candidate. I have helped with other ones, but generally, when I start helping, it's towards the end of the summer. Other than that, it's informal advising, helping people with the media presence and this type of thing. And so I spend about 5 minutes every day sitting there fairly anxious that I should be doing something that I'm not doing, that I'm falling behind because I'm not knocking on doors right now. And then I have to think back to the conversations I've had with more veteran organizers who are just like, if you start now, you're going to burn out your volunteers, your people are going to be tired of hearing about you, and you're going to confuse people because you're not going to be on their ballot a whole lot of it. Beyond that, I'm also waiting for the weather to get a little nicer to do a real door knocking.
Well, if you were in Vermont, you'd be waiting until summer. But
Right. It's what we've been really working on right now is our social media presence and repetition about the themes that we're talking about. And I really, if nothing else, I will consider it a win at the end of November if the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights is something that more candidates are talking about, that more people have heard of, and that more people are saying, hey, actually our government should have a role in making sure that we can have a job and a living wage and a right to collective bargaining and decent, safe, and affordable housing and a right to broadband, and the list goes on. That will be, I consider, a very much a win. And it's resonating with people. I mean, a lot of people kind of go, yeah, I agree with those things, but that's awful abstract. How do you make that happen? And what I keep on having to say is, well, the first thing we do is recognize that these are rights that we want to fight for, because right. You can't build a house with no blueprints. You can't exercise of any sort of political progress without knowing what the hell you're going for. And so the first step is identifying all of those things. And then we can talk about how to get there. And there are certainly, you know, I know that the conservatives and the Republicans across the aisle, so to speak, they will say that they have their own ways of guaranteeing a decent, safe, affordable housing, and that'll be to let the market do its work, its magic. And so that we know will be on one side of the extreme. And then we have thousands of potential other solutions that move from, you know, outright public ownership of every house that needs to, every person who needs a house, to sub, you know, a little bit more subsidies and maybe just laying off the ways that we block people from housing, for instance, with three strikes laws and things like this. There's a lot of things that go into these once you get past it, right? One of the I've been thinking about a lot recently, because Colorado just passed through their legislature a bill banning junk fees, which basically says, you know, the price that you're seeing on for a product should be the price you pay, which I don't think is a terribly extreme thing, but lots of Americans, lots of West Virginians are ripped off every day because they go to buy something and it's not until the very end of the process that they find out that it's actually $12 more. Well, that's fighting for a fair and just economic system, which is another one of the 21st century economic bill of rights. And again, that sounds really abstract, a fair and just economic system. What the hell does that mean? Well, we can start by saying it means you can't add $10. You can't add a price to the end that people haven't agreed to up front. So we take it one piece at a time.
Let me take it up a slightly different direction. I posted a video this morning on Labor Radio site on our JB maintains the Labor Beat Radio Facebook group, and it's called Mouse Land, and it's a animation of a speech given by Tommy Douglas, who was the 9-time premier of Saskatchewan and elected to the House of Commons.
A great video.
House of Commons in Canada, and in 1935 he gave this famous classic address called Mouseland, and which, you know, is about living in Mouseland, but the cats run the government. And whether it's a black cat or a white cat, or a cat that's half white and half black, or a white cat with black spots, the problem is it's Mouseland. And so Bernie Sanders, when he started his campaigns in Vermont, before he did that, he was present at every strike that took place in Vermont. He was present during the mass unemployment in 81, bringing food. This is before he was mayor, and he never grandstanded, ever. He brought food, he brought clothing, he walked the picket line, he talked to people. Well, he always talked, okay, because he's a big talker. But, and by the time, you know, I attended a meeting at the Vermont Labor Council with him in Burlington, right when he was running for mayor, he didn't have any money. And I said, we kept asking him, well, we don't have that much money to give you, you know, so, we might give you, you know, a few hundred dollars, but what are you going to do? He says, well, let's try out something. Now he was an old YSA organizer from way, way back, you know, or activist. And so we drove out and with one of his other friends there. We drove out and listened to the police band radio. Until he heard an accident was taking place where the police were going to be at. So we go there, and the cops are on the scene, and there's been a death, and it's a bad situation, and the press is out there too, you know, but the cops won't talk to him. Bernie gets out of the car. I have something to say about it. You know, and he started showing up at all these crisis scenes, right? And when the cops wouldn't talk, Bernie would say something, you know, about exactly the arrangement that led to the engineering of this particular intersection in the town of Burlington, right? You know, he would do that stuff. And he developed a certain, it was a tactical thing that was very gifted, and it worked. And by the time he wasn't campaigning, he was explaining, you know, a hot situation. Why did that ship run in and knock down, you know, the bridge in the Baltimore Harbor this morning? Okay. I mean, Bernie would be there, you know, with the answer for anybody who wanted to hear. Okay. And so it wasn't, he didn't wear anybody out. Now, in Jefferson County, so I'd say that as a prelude to what I'm going to ask you, which is all this development going on in your district. I drive along Rolling Springs Road. I see it. It's massive. It's not yet. And the developers are, Dan Ryan, for example, is not pre-funding the sewage, water, education, biggest cost in the county. Any of that, okay? So there's a collision coming down the road, you know, over the development versus the infrastructure support to be able to do it. And it's going to be reflected in the attitudes of people, most importantly, probably, to either police support, fire support, or the school system with their kids. And in my view, you know, the Mouseland approach is the teachers, the parents of the students, and the public and emergency services workers who will be directly impacted by the very three things that Liz Shuler summarized in her report on this past year's strike. Wages, what's the benefits, and what's the workload? Okay, the infrastructure, you know, the support, who's going to pay? And West Virginia is too poor to tax. West Virginia is too poor to tax the people of West Virginia. If you try to tax them, the Republicans and the fascists will just tear you apart. They'll play games with that all day long, okay, and kill you. And the farmers are too poor to tax. The only way they are in business at all, this generation down, given the role of agribusiness, is if they have the tax breaks that they currently get for agricultural land, okay? And you can see the whole bunch have given up right along Flowing Springs Road, okay? So if you can't, so where are you gonna raise the money to do what needs to be done in West Virginia? And what are these core constituencies, if they all went on strike, all of them, you know, they say, shut it down, or we want these needs met. So then the answer would be, who pays? Where does it come from?
Right.
That's my
question. And it's a tough question, and nobody ever wants to come out and say, I am in favor of taxation in any kind. Immediately then you're right, you're attacked by Republicans or even Blue Dog Democrats who will say, you know, taxation without representation. Now, my point would be, of course, we have representation. So, you know, unless I lived in D.C. for almost a decade where we did have taxation without representation. But in the rest of the country, we do have representation in our House of Delegates and our Senate here in West Virginia. So I would say, well, one exploration, one place to raise revenue would be to legalize and tax cannabis and have that money go directly, you know, a lot of that money go directly to the communities that have been ravaged by the opioid crisis. And we, you know, when, to do that, we, of course, have to sidestep all sorts of arguments that cannabis is a gateway drug and actually you'd just be making the problem worse and all this, which are bad faith arguments, but you'll confront them nonetheless. The other things I would say we have to look at are things like a wealth tax, looking at how many people who, because West Virginians as on a whole are too poor to tax, but there is a lot of wealth here. There are very wealthy people who are sitting on that wealth and are planning on passing it down intergenerationally. A couple of other things I've been trying to think about how to make work are, you know, here in Jefferson County, a lot of this land is not only being developed for housing and the infrastructure shortfall that you described, but also being used for large-scale solar farming, which I have no problem with on its base. I would like to see the energy help to make things more affordable for West Virginians. And so one of the things I've been sort of thinking about, and I would love to talk to more people who might have a little bit more sense about this, but taxing basically the export of energy. And yeah, it raises prices for the export of the energy, but those aren't West Virginian consumers, and those taxes could then be used to reinvest into our infrastructure for any number of things. I should also take a step back and say that we are operating under a lot of myths in West Virginia about the state of our budget, right? Because of the gamesmanship from the majority party, who are the Republicans. You know, we spent the last half of last year, most of last year, being told that there was this big budget surplus and that the tax breaks for the wealthiest had done all this good, but we can't spend the surplus on any of the things that we need to, because, you know, we just need to have a surplus. There's this some form of thinking that says, because if we assume that government should be run like households, then having big surpluses is like having a big savings account, and that's a good thing for a state. And I actually confronted State Senator Patricia Rucker about this at one point, and had to point out that when the money is sitting there in a surplus, it does nothing for the economy. You have to put that back into infrastructure. You have to put that back into spending, whether it's raising teachers' wages, whether it's lowering the cost of PEIA premiums so that we're not starving our public employees of healthcare and the benefits that they've earned and deserve, and we all deserve, frankly. But so we're operating under this myth that there was a surplus that doesn't exist. Now we're looking at $500 million that we might owe back to the federal government in the state because we didn't spend it on the educational things properly that we should have. There's research for gun violence. There's funding for gun research or gun violence research that is probably going to have to go back to the federal government because we didn't spend it on it. And more than that, there's a lot of land in West Virginia that's just sitting there under out-of-state ownership, waiting for it to become economically profitable or viable, or waiting for another 30 years to clear the tree stand. And I would think that one of the ways we can solve this is with something like a land value tax, where we're not doing an ad valorem tax on the improvements, the structures on top. But if you're sitting there with a huge tract, a whole mountain of land that is not being developed, is not being able to be used for any productive purpose because it's being hoarded, then I think you should have to pay a tax on that annually. And that revenue should be able to go towards whatever we decide we need it to go to. And so those are a couple of the options I would look at. And I think that we also can, I think we should be, and could be able to roll back some of the tax cuts that have been put into place, at least for the highest earners. We are now in a world where $100,000 a year is actually not super rich anymore. This is not the 1960s where $100,000 a year is 2 to 3 families worth of income, household income.
Right.
We are now in a place where I think that if you're making up to $150,000, that's a good paying, probably a union job in the blue collar workforce. We should be able to figure out a way to not raise taxes back on those earners while still collecting from, I don't know, the debt lords like Jim Justice of the world, who are clearly cleaning up on income. And We need to be finding ways to make sure that we're not, it's hard to roll back on, because there was a bipartisan consensus starting in the late 80s and into the 90s that said that free trade, global trade, deregulation of markets is a necessary good thing that is the only way you can proffer development into places, including the developing countries. And West Virginia falls into a similar category. We're just inside of a developed country, but we're a developing region. What has ended up happening for the last 30 years is that there are a lot of brownfield sites that weren't there anymore. And a lot of wealth has been passed through regions because these corporations were given tax breaks and everything like this. And then they packed up and left. They sold off the property and have left us with stranded assets that require investment in order to even make productive again. So we've been left in the hole twice. And climbing out of that is not going to be easy. And it is going to require robust investment in public infrastructure. And I'm going to bring this back around to what you're saying about the development and infrastructure on Flowing Springs Road, for instance. I consider police, fire, teachers, and yes, even sanitation services. These are all, in many ways, first responders. I mean, police and fire people, we understand as first responders, EMS, of course. And we are struggling with all of this in the county as it is because of the structure of West Virginia's EMS services and fire services. Teachers, I think, is a very easy case to make that they're first responders, beyond the fact that they are the ones who are going to determine how the youth of today turn into the adults and the leadership and workforce of tomorrow. Even the Republicans seem to agree that teachers are first responders in that they're trying to arm them in the classrooms. Now, I don't think that's necessarily the response, but they are the ones who are going to see whether a child is abused at home. They are the ones who are going to be able to pick up on, if a child suddenly becomes depressed. You know, they are very much the first responders in our society for our children. And they should be compensated as such. We do a lot of praise of the thin blue line and our firefighters and all of this, and teachers somehow then get cast off as groomers and pedophiles by our legislators. And of course, sanitation and sewage workers, without this infrastructure, without these workers, I was not alive at the time, but I've seen pictures of New York City in the 1970s. And we've seen also, you know, here are haulers that where people can't get to collect the trash. There's plenty of rubbish there. And that affects all of us. That affects our quality of life today. And that affects our quality of life in the future. And ultimately, I went to school for development and economics, and I resent the fact that part of the training is that you come down to breaking things down into dollars and cents. Life years, work years lost in dollars and cents there. But the reality is the lack of public investment, what we could gather from taxes, let me put it this way, what we could gather from taxes, if we could all agree that, you know, these taxes are things that we need to live in a society that we want to live in, far outweighs the costs that we bear by not collecting these taxes.
Right.
And not investing in these things now. And that's hard for people to understand. I mean, I do get that. Even for politicians across the aisle, I think that there are a lot of people who have a hard time thinking beyond 4 or 5 years out and thinking into their child's actual lifetime and their children's children. Again, I could talk all day, but yeah. It's not my program.
Scott, you got any other thoughts? Did we lose Scott?
No, he's there.
Okay.
No, I'm. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Now yeah. I can. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. One other thing I wondered about is the support you're getting from the rest of the labor movement. How does that look?
I think good. I have not received any other endorsements at this point. The state AFL-CIO is my lone endorsement at this point, but I think that's a good bellwether. And you know, whether the labor movement will come out in full support of me, there's plenty of things that that I will certainly disagree with people on. I grew up in Wheeling, and I have serious hesitance about the benefits of fracking for any economic outcome or anything like that. And I know that'll put me at odds with certain members of the labor, but I will continue to fight for the labor movement and the members of the labor and workers. And, you know, I fight even for non-union laborers, but I know that the best way to fight for non-union laborers is to fight for unions.
That's right. And we've overrun our time slot.
I think you've been
by at least 20 minutes, but it was worth it. It was worth it.
Sure is.
I think we should have Troy on at least once a month.
Well, if we can get him, you know, he's going to be awful busy here. But yeah, we'll
it's
love
only
to have
for
him.
Half hour, John.
Yeah, I know, but we you know,
normally
half hour is a lot of time.
I was about to start an argument with him, but I'm not going to now. You know, so
save that for the next time. Exactly,
that will make it. Well, you'd be another hour. So anyway, yeah, you got to come back.
I will happily come back as often as I can.
We'll just call it the Troy Miller Show. And just, you know,
well, yeah. That's right.
Stop all this labor beat
stuff. All right. Well, Troy, thank you so much for joining us today. We had a good time. I think we all learned a lot. I really enjoyed you drilling down and into some of the details and thoughts, and appreciate that very much. And we look forward to keep talking, and helping
thank you
out.
So much.
All right. All right. Everybody, this is Labor Beat Radio Show, and on Enlightened Radio, you can always get to us on www.enlightenedradio.org, and the player is always on at player.enlightenedradio.org. And coming up next is The Dead South, a very cool bluegrass band. So, take care, everybody. It's late, but everything comes next.
Thank you.